From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More than 90% of the population of Gaza is food insecure. That's at least 1.6 out of Gaza's total population of 1.8 million people, according to Robert Piper, the UN coordinator for humanitarian aid and development activities in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinating Agency, a total of $571 million is needed to help the most vulnerable people in the occupied Palestinian territories this year alone. The agency made the announcement as it opened its 2016 appeal in Ramallah Wednesday. Daniel Johnson has more.
This year's humanitarian response plan aims to provide vital assistance to 1.6 million people who are classified as moderately or severely food insecure. Robert Piper, the UN coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territory, described many Palestinians as highly vulnerable after nearly 50 years of occupation by Israel. And he said that the coping capacity of families was at the point of exhaustion. In total, more than 4 million people live in the occupied Palestinian territories, which covers Gaza and the West Bank. Nearly 44% of this number are refugees, and nearly half are below 18 years of age. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Russia warned of Turkey's intent to create a so-called ISIL-free zone in northern Syria. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said such a move would be in breach of international law. He said it would cause substantial and qualitative tension in the region. Turkey, with the help of the U.S., has been trying to operationalize a buffer zone in the northern part of Syria. Ankara claims the move will lead to greater stability along the border. Others say Turkey is seeking to gain control over the situation in Syria and crack down on minority Kurds, against whom Ankara has launched a military campaign on its own soil. At least 4 people were killed when a minibus tried to skip a line of vehicles at a checkpoint in eastern Ukraine and hit a landmine. Those 4 were killed and several others injured not far from the village of Mariinka in the Donetsk region in the early hours of Wednesday, according to Donetsk police. The driver and 2 passengers died on the spot, according to RBC Ukraine, and another person with serious wounds was taken to a hospital where he succumbed to his injuries. A family car with 3 people inside was also damaged by the blast, with family members suffering wounds of varying severity, according to a source from the DPR law enforcement. The incident took place at the dividing line between Kiev's and rebel troops on the Donetsk side, that according to a spokesperson for the Donetsk Regional Police. The political wrangling among the members of the U.S.-backed government in Ukraine continues to reach new heights of absurdity. This is some of the sound of one of the latest examples of a physical assault inside the Ukrainian parliament, where, in the closing days of last year, Mikhail Saakashvili, now the governor of Odessa in Ukraine, and the former president of the nation of Georgia, accuses the acting prime minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and the interior minister, Arsen Avakov, of corruption. The video shows Avakov in a committee meeting throwing a glass of water across the room at Saakashvili in reply. Given the ultra-nationalist ideology underpinning the 2014 coup in Kiev, and the current government as well, Ukraine has an extraordinary number of non-Ukrainian foreign nationals in senior government posts, including 5 Georgian nationals, all of whom are wanted in their own country on criminal charges for corruption, and 1 Lithuanian member who tried to resign but learned his resignation was rejected by the current Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko. According to media reports, Yatsenyuk's post as prime minister was offered to former Swedish foreign minister Carl Bildt. Bildt has an interesting resume, which includes a 2-year stint in the 1990s as the de facto ruler of Bosnia. For more on this, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, journalist and editor at the Sputnik News Agency, via Skype from Moscow Wednesday. The Rada looks like the WWF here. They have fights almost every session now. What's going on there?
I think the problem is deeper than just fights between the so-called Ukrainian politicians. The problem is that the United States, invests its huge financial and sometimes military capabilities into absolutely worthless and sometimes dangerous people in Eastern Europe. So the fight that you have seen, you know, this is the interior minister of Ukraine, Arsen Avakov, throwing a glass of water at Mikhail Saakashvili, who is the former president of Georgia, and he is now the governor of Odessa, a Russian-speaking region in the south of Ukraine, a very important city for all of Russians because some of our best writers stem from that city, especially in the 20th century. Some of Russia's best writers were from Odessa. They called themselves Odessites. So basically, I'm glad that Mr. Saakashvili, whom the United States fully supported in his brief war with Russia in 2008, I'm glad that he now is heading a Russian-speaking region because now he has to speak Russian, and we can see him on YouTube, and I can tell you that he is an absolutely insane person. And you can see that during this fight with Avakov, because the problem is that Saakashvili cannot hear any objections for longer than 2 seconds. He immediately starts to attack the person who is you know, presenting his arguments to him, calling him corrupt, calling him Soviet, calling him an idiot, and that's what happened between Saakashvili and Avakov. You know, Avakov, when Saakashvili didn't let him speak for 2 seconds, he just threw a glass of water in Saakashvili's face. And I can tell you that I'm a little jealous to Avakov because it was Saakashvili who started the war in 2008 by attacking the small separatist, well, he calls them separatists, but in fact they were just fleeing Georgian genocide. He attacked that small region of South Ossetia, which became independent of Georgia in 1991, when Georgia became a nationalist state. And he has a lot of blood on his hands. And also, Mr. Saakashvili is the person who named a street in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, after George Bush the Jr. In general, I'm not a great fan of naming streets after living people, but naming a street after George Bush the Jr., that is right. Just too much for right. me.
Even here so, in the United States, they don't do that.
Yes, yes. Well, they don't do it anyway, except in Eastern Europe, you know, some of the political leaders who are just so completely dependent on the American leaders, they name streets after them. This is very much like what was done under Stalin in the Soviet Union, you know, naming whole cities after living people. And basically, Ukraine is just one of the examples. If you look at the other countries, that other regimes, rather, that the United States support in Eastern Europe, you will see the same story. Today, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that NATO would expand in Eastern Europe, taking new countries in. So the same dangerous policy of antagonizing Russia and taking new countries into NATO continues. And that means that more and more countries are in danger of being obliged to have a war with Russia or to send their young people to places like Iraq or Afghanistan.
You know, I want to get to Carl Bildt and, you know, that whole thing with the former Swedish foreign minister who was looking at maybe being the prime minister of Ukraine. But what you just said happens in the context of, you know, very near military encounters between Russia and Turkey, including actually an actual shootdown by Turkey of a Russian plane. The threat or promise or in any event, the statement that there are going to be foreign troops invading Syria from Saudi Arabia and Turkey, a NATO country, even coordinating with U.S. Command and control on the ground. And they would be basically fighting with Russian troops or Russian Air Force because they're working with the Syrian government. And all of these new additions to NATO on the ground mean the placement of more military hardware up against Russia and personnel. Isn't this getting a little scary?
Well, it's getting scarier and scarier every day. And this is a problem of, I would say, two crazy entities making each other crazier and crazier. On the one hand, you have adventurous political leaders in the countries like Ukraine or Turkey. Mr. Erdogan, who at some moment decided that he could control the neighboring country, Syria. So suddenly, after many years of friendship with the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad, suddenly Erdogan declared Syria a country where there is no freedom and started supporting the opposition there, not exactly the opposition, but rather the armed uprising. In the same way, Ukraine, which has been viewed as a brotherly, fraternal nation, and Russians even didn't make a difference between Russians and Ukrainians for many years, suddenly the United States helped a very anti-Russian regime to be installed in Kyiv, you know, the capital of Ukraine. And these places are getting more and more, zones of danger because they challenge Russia in every possible way. And behind the ocean, you have the United States with its State Department run by very incompetent people who support every action of the Ukrainian government, of the Turkish government. They keep talking about NATO solidarity. So if, heaven forbid, there is any kind of military action between the Russian planes and the Turkish planes in Turkey, that may lead to World War III. So under Mr. Obama, I would say that Europe and the Middle East, they have become, again, for the second time in the last 100 years, zones of great instability and of great danger for the whole world. A new world war indeed may start in some of these places.
So, all right. So now, looking at Ukraine, for example, this anti-Russian government that's in place rests on the stoking of nationalist sentiment in the western part of Ukraine against the other Ukrainians who are of Russian ancestry. And this ultra-nationalist ideology, Nazi ideology at the heart of it, that's used to make some cohesion in the western Ukrainian body politic, has sitting at the top of it non-Ukrainians. They keep importing people to run the government. What's up?
Well, this is really very strange because if you look at the Ukrainian government, just recently they pondered the possibility of making Carl Bildt a Swede, you know, the prime minister. They already have several Georgians there. All of them are former members of Saakashvili's government in Tbilisi. All of them have, all of them are wanted in Georgia for corruption by the new government that won a democratic, honest election in 2012. There is one Lithuanian there, Abramavičius, the Minister of Economics, who just recently said he was blackmailed by Mr. Poroshenko's supporters in the Rada, that they forced him to have a corrupt deputy. So Mr. Abramavičius tendered his resignation. He just refuses to take it back, despite Mr. Poroshenko asking him to stay. And in general, let me explain you the ideology of the new Ukrainian regime. It's not ethnic fascism, only a part of it, only a part of the new regime are ethnic fascists. The main thing for this new regime is that you should accept their narrative about the 20th century and about the history of Ukraine and Russia in general. And that narrative is that, the Nazi Germany was no worse than the Soviet Union, that Ukraine was occupied and not liberated by the Soviet army, that nothing good can come from Moscow, that Russians are some kind of an inferior nation which has not done to Ukraine anything but evil. And if you accept that narrative, you can be Lithuanian or you can be Armenian or you can be Georgian, you will be accepted into this new regime. So this is a political, I would say, even historic fascism, more than just ethnic fascism. And if you look at that scandalous moment, when Mr. Avakov, an ethnic Armenian and the new interior minister of Ukraine, when he threw a glass of water at Saakashvili, yelling at him in Russian, this was just a comedy. There were an ethnic Armenian and an ethnic Georgian, both of them members of the new nationalist Ukrainian regime, throwing glasses of water at each other and finding out who of them is the greatest Ukrainian nationalist. And unfortunately, absurd things like that happen. They would be funny if the situation around Ukraine had not been so, so very dangerous, because the United States supports every move of this new regime. It presents this regime as almost ideally democratic in its media. And when it criticizes this regime, it only criticizes it for corruption. While this regime is not just corrupt, well, it is extremely corrupt, but it is also very violent. You know, it displaced hundreds of thousands of people in the east of the country. And it is very, very aggressive towards its big neighbor, Russia.
Which is a pretty dangerous game to play.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if Ukraine gets into a real conflict with Russia, and if the United States continues to support unconditionally every move of this Ukrainian regime, you may get the war between Russia and the United States. And the war between Russia and the United States is the end of the world.
Yeah. I'm looking at the logic of the U.S. State Department, the political logic that they're using to justify the insertion of troops from Saudi Arabia and Turkey into sovereign Syria without a U.N. Security Council resolution, and that being the evils of the Syrian government and the fact that it's lost its legitimacy by declaration, by fiat from Washington. If that is going to be the new standard for international law, because that is going to be a reality on the ground, apparently, within days, then if that new can't that new standard be applied to Ukraine by Russia?
Well, unfortunately, international law has been breached by all sides in the last 25 years, and it was not Russia who started breaching it. If you look at you know, the statements from the State Department that Helsinki agreements, you know, signed in the early 70s, they are sacred, they should be kept working. Well, I mean, Helsinki agreements have been breached back in the 90s many times. You know, when East Germany joined West Germany, that was already a breach of the Helsinki agreements. When Slovakia left Czechoslovakia, it was also a breach of that agreement. When NATO expanded to the countries which were even part of the Soviet Union during the Soviet times, when NATO expanded to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, that was certainly a breach of the spirit of the Helsinki Agreement, and that was a breach of the NATO-Russia Founding Act in 2007. So, unfortunately, international law and international treaties, they are pretty much dead now for practical reasons, you know. And of course, what's going on in the Middle East is just a continuation of that process. Mrs. Clinton had no right to interfere in Syria and to support the armed uprising there. But we remember how she even suggested paying salaries to the Syrian soldiers if they leave the Syrian government army. And it shows that the State Department did not understand what was going on in Syria. They thought it was just an evil dictator paying his stooges, and they didn't understand that it was a terrible religious and ethnic war, where if you know, the Syrian government soldiers defect or if they surrender, their families will either be destroyed or they will have to emigrate to some other country, because the so-called Islamic State and other radical Islamist organizations opposing the Syrian government, they are not going to tolerate any kind of religious minorities on the territory that they control. So, indeed, the idea that Turkey or Saudi Arabia can invade Syria, the idea that they can somehow act against the Russian Air Force there, which is in Syria on an invitation from the Syrian government, this is a pretty dangerous idea. But we have now dangers everywhere. We have Saudi Arabia invading neighboring Yemen, where the population is very belligerent and very able to resist foreign aggressions. We have that constant instability in the east of Ukraine, where the Ukrainian forces are still encircling the so-called separatists who control just 3% of the Ukrainian territory. Why not allow these people who are obviously supporters of Russia, who speak Russian more than Ukrainian, and who want to live separately from the regime in Kyiv, why not give them these goddamn 3% of the Ukrainian territory? This is a question which I don't think State Department is able to answer.
I was chatting with Mark Sloboda and Eric Draitzer over the weekend for our weekend program, and one of the things that occurred to me in the process of discussing the Saudis coming in is that actually it wouldn't require any transportation being utilized, but rather just airdropping some new uniforms behind the lines, because so many of the armed groups there are either command and controlled by the Saudis, certainly funded and armed by the Saudis, and even include Saudis already among them.
Well, that's true, and in reality, there is plenty of evidence that Saudis and Qataris and other foreign actors, they were in Syria during even during the so-called peaceful demonstrations in 2011, which were lauded by the United States and by the European Union as an expression of the people's will. The reality is that all of the so-called Arab Spring cracked up to be a huge disaster. I mean, the Middle East has never seen such devastating wars as the ones that that happened there after the Arab Spring. And let me remind you that the United States welcomed the Arab Spring. Let me tell you Mr. Wolfowitz, who had been the head of the Freedom House before the Arab Spring, let me remind you how he told people in the Middle East that we're going to come after Mubarak, we're going to come after all these dictators, there will be a democratic revolution in the Middle East after we're done in Iraq. And this is exactly what happened. But these revolutions were not democratic, they were devastating, and they led to very bloody civil wars. So Mr. Wolfowitz cracked up to be right, but not in the way he would like to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd revolution, by the way, that took place in Libya that required the United States Air Force to bomb the country of 6 million people for almost 9 months daily.
That's true, and not only the United States, but also France and Britain. And it's just amazing how the leaders of these countries, how they never bore any responsibility for that. And how now Mr. Cameron stays in power, despite the fact that, let me remind you, in 2011, he came to Tripoli, he came to Libya, and he promised Libyans blooming horizons. You know, I remember how he spoke to the Libyans at the time. And it all turned out to be fakes and lies, and he is still in power in Great Britain, and we are told that people in the UK honestly vote for him. I doubt that, because if I were an Englishman, I would see immediately how much that person lied, not only on Libya, but later also on Ukraine. And the problem is that he keeps lying.
You know, let's go back to Bild for a minute. Maybe you could tell people a little bit about his pedigree, particularly his experience in the former Yugoslavia.
Well, I think this is the reason why Poroshenko, you know, the Ukrainian president, why he toyed with the idea of making Karl Bildt the new prime minister. If we look at Karl Bildt's biography, he is one of the most powerful people in Europe, despite not holding any official positions right now. He was the so-called high representative in Bosnia between 1995 and 1997. And the high representative in Bosnia at the time was basically the de facto ruler of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So what happened then was that the United States forced the Catholics and the Muslims to form a federation in Bosnia. And in 1995, in order to have that federation win the war with Serbs, Mr. Bildt and others talked Slobodan Milosevic in neighboring Serbia into not supporting the ethnic Serbs in Bosnia. You remember probably that the agreement was reached in Dayton.
Yes.
We know now for sure that in exchange, Mr. Milosevic was promised so-called security guarantees by an American diplomat, now late Richard Holbrooke. These security guarantees, of course, cracked up to be a fake. We remember what happened to Milosevic later. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Poroshenko obviously likes the way BILT operated in Bosnia. So he hopes probably that the BILT would do the same thing in Ukraine. In Ukraine right now, there is a very fashionable theme to discuss. You know, Ukrainians look at the example of Croatia. Croatia had a brief war with Serbia in 1992. It lost this war. You know, the small Serb entity on the territory of Croatia, the so-called Serb Krajina, stayed intact. So Croatia waited for three more years until 1995. They waited for the moment when Milosevic would look the other way, and they suddenly attacked Serb Krajina. In fact, ethnically cleansing it in a matter of several days. And the Western media did not react in any way. Right now, Mr. Poroshenko is openly telling his people, this is what we should do with the so-called separatists in Donbas. And that's why we need Carl Bildt with us, because he was instrumental in doing that in Croatia. I don't think that these people will be able to deceive Donbas people or Russia in general letting them repeat the so-called Croatian scenario. Primarily because we already know what happened in the former Yugoslavia. And Mr. Putin knows what happened to Milosevic. So there is absolutely no trust left in Russia for the people like Carl Bildt.
And it's interesting that they pick someone that comes out of Croatia that way. Given Croatia's history during World War II, the Ukrainian nationalists who go back to Bandera and World War II, and the role that the partisans, the Yugoslav partisans from Serbia and the rest of Yugoslavia played fighting the Germans. They and the Greeks were the two that really beat the Germans on that front.
Well, you just touched upon a huge problem. The real problem is that the European Union and the United States, they support in Eastern Europe the same groups, the same political entities that cooperated with Nazis during the World War II. They supported Croatians against Serbs in Yugoslavia. They support Latvians and Estonians against their own Russian minorities in the Baltics. The West in general supports, for example, Georgian and Ukrainian nationalists who also helped Hitler fight the Red Army in the 40s. So this is a very troubling development. The fact that ethnic Jews are actually pursuing this policy in the United States State Department, I think this is the real insult to the memory of the Holocaust victims, because the Jews in Eastern Europe, as you might know from historical research, they were destroyed in most of the cases, not even by the German Nazis, but by the local Nazis, who actively cooperated with Germans in destroying the Jewish population. I had an interview with Ephraim Zurov, the head of Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem. And he told me that, the difference between the French collaborators and, say, the Ukrainian collaborators was that in France, at worst, they took the Jews to the train station to be transported to the concentration camps. In places like Ukraine or Latvia, the local collaborators, they either killed the Jews on the spot with a tacit agreement from the Germans, or they even worked in the death camps, which destroyed the Jews. So the cooperation with the Nazis was much more widespread in places like Western Ukraine, the Baltics, Croatia. And the fact that people in the United States who claim to remember Holocaust, you know, that these same people support the same groups which stem from the events of the 1940s. This is just outrageous, and it's a very sinister development to my mind.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.